From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Texas legislature votes no to expand Medicaid in the state. With the recent loss of the 1115 waiver, this could mean a health care crisis for poor and rural Texas. And during the pandemic, access to public information in Texas was sometimes on mute. What's happening at the ledge to fix this? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thursday at the Texas Legislature was Budget Day, with a marathon session on the House floor, where nearly 240 amendments to the budget were voted on. At one point, State Representative Garnet Coleman, a Houston Democrat, stepped up to the mic and pitched his amendment that would expand state and federal health care coverage for the uninsured in Texas.
Tragically, Texas has the unfortunate distinction of having both the highest number and the highest percentage of uninsured residents in the nation.
It was a way to basically expand Medicaid with options for Texas Republican leadership to tailor it to their needs and to make it more politically acceptable to their base.
It would direct HHSC to develop a delivery model that would promote personal responsibility, increase efficiency and accessibility of services, and reduce health care costs to the state. Also, the control of this particular amendment would be in Governor Abbott, the Health and Human Services Commission. So that's important because it is not prescriptive to anything except the principles of Texas.
But after about 20 minutes of debate, the amendment failed with a vote of 68-80, largely along political lines, one Republican, State Representative Lyle Larson of San Antonio, voting for it. Larson later tweeted, "All major medical groups in Texas asked the ledge to increase federal health care dollars coming to Texas. Unfortunately, we are stuck in a decades-old narrative that has forced the closing of many rural hospitals and less access to physician care. Fiscal conservatism was denied today." We're going to hear more about how this vote, paired with the 1115 waiver that was recently pulled from Texas, how this 1-2 punch is going to hurt poor and rural Texans. But first, even before Thursday's vote, Texans in rural communities were facing a growing crisis as their hospitals shutter. According to the Texas Newsroom and American Public Media, the state has the highest rate of hospital closures in the U.S. Texas Tech Public Media's Jamie Lozano reports that as rural residents lose access to health care, one team is working to restore hospitals in the areas that need them most.
Hello, ladies.
This is April. She started today with us. She's going to be the clinic manager for our office.
Randy Lindauer makes his daily rounds through the Van Zandt Regional Hospital. He checks on building renovation and greets new staff.
Okay. How are you, Randy?
You got a minute?
Come on back.
Randy is in charge of reopening this hospital. But it's not just a hospital. It's an entire medical hub.
I don't care. Whenever you want or not, I'm available. You know me, 24/7.
Okay.
For more than four decades, Randy has overseen operations at clinics and facilities in rural areas around the nation. He's worked in Kansas, West Virginia, Florida, Indiana, and now Texas.
I mean, I look at the community and see what their needs are and what has happened in the past.
This time, he's reopening his first full-service hospital, Van Zandt, after it closed in 2019.
What time? Not early. He gets up at 4:30.
The small, one-story brick building is in Grand Saline, a remote town in East Texas. It can house upwards of 50 patients and serves as Van Zandt County's only hospital.
We're there for one specific reason, and that is to provide quality care. I mean, if we wasn't about that, I would not have come here. I didn't come here for the money. I've been doing this for, like I said, 44 years, and hospitals belong in the rural community.
Once Randy got there, he says the scene at the Van Zandt Hospital was horrific.
The brick was all discolored, and where we put the vinyl, it had some whiteboards there that were rotten and chipped. The trees were horrible. They were just out of control. The sign they had down there was rotten.
Randy lives in the hospital. It's his home away from home.
This is where
His workday starts at 4 a.m. and typically lasts until 10, and that's if he finds the time to sleep. He lives in a quaint makeshift bedroom tucked away inside, in a spare twin-size hospital bed with white sheets pulled tightly over the mattress.
My sleeping room, because I'm here 24/7, because you never know when a pipe's going to break, and when you put in 18 hours a day, you just need someplace to lay your head.
One night, two men walked in and claimed that they thought the hospital was abandoned. Instead, they found Randy.
And they walked all the way back to ER and my room. And I had the door open. I was just laying there in my t-shirt and stuff. And they said, "We heard there was a ghost here." I said, "Well, I'm the only ghost here." And I said, "I will escort you to the front entrance."
The hospital was abandoned by its previous owners. And Randy was haunted by everything they left behind.
We have emptied 8 30-yard dumpsters worth of junk. We have shredded, 18,431 pounds of outdated medical records that the former owners had in here that needed to be shredded. I mean, that cost us $8,000.
Randy is now the hospital's CEO. He was hired to renovate it by Innate Medical Solutions, a healthcare provider focused on helping rural communities access better healthcare. When the hospital closed in 2019, 56,000 people in the region were left without easy access to healthcare. The decision came hours after the previous owners held a town luncheon, promising they would stay forever. It closed within 48 hours.
It's a slap in the face when you think you have healthcare one day and the next day it's gone. It's taken away from you. You know, to get to Tyler from here, it's over an hour.
Randy is talking about Tyler, Texas, which has the closest hospital for people living in Grand Saline.
How many lives could have been saved over the past year if they would have had a hospital here locally?
A post on the hospital's Facebook page broke the news to the public, explaining that it closed because of Medicare cutbacks and low reimbursements from insurance companies. The problem isn't limited to Van Zandt County. Data from American Public Media Research Lab shows 85 counties in Texas have no hospital at all. Since 2005, 24 rural hospitals have closed, more than any other state in the nation.
I was born in a hospital like this in West Texas. And then my mother worked in a hospital like this. My aunts worked in hospitals like this all their lives. These are becoming extinct.
That's Dr. Gary Martin, Randy's colleague and CEO of Innate Medical Solutions, which now owns the hospital. Van Zandt is the first full hospital the team has tackled. It's a bigger project, and Gary has used his personal finances and even his retirement fund on the hospital. They are waiting for licenses from the state and can't see patients until then, making them go over budget significantly. While the team is hopeful, there are challenges when a closed hospital reopens, most of which come from the high uninsured rate, 21% in Van Zandt County, or a lack of funds in the state budget for Medicaid patients.
When the hospital closes, there's an inherent distrust that that hospital might not make it again.
That's Don McBeth with the Texas Organization of Rural and Community Hospitals.
That's what keeps you alive. Rural hospitals could be very important in your life. What has happened again starting 10 years ago was we had some Medicare programs that went away. We had a Medicare across-the-board payment cut.
All of these factors have contributed to the string of closures seen across the state.
Losses for the rural hospitals.
Back in Van Zandt, Randy is preparing as it gets closer to the hospital reopening by the start of the summer. That includes buying used furniture and fixing anything that needs repairs.
So we bargain shop as well.
Recently, he was able to take a break and see his wife and daughters. The work is almost done in Van Zandt, but it's not finished in Texas. Randy's team is scouting other rural communities to help.
You know, you have to ask, you have to wear many hats, where it's a safety director or a maintenance technician or CEO or whatever.
From Lubbock, I'm Jamie Lozano.
You know, because it saves you a lot of money.
It was last week that the Biden administration announced that it was rescinding the 1115 waiver for Texas. This waiver was extended by the Trump administration to provide a health care safety net for uninsured Texans. The 1115 waiver reimburses hospitals for uncompensated care that they provide to patients without health insurance, and it pays for innovative health care projects that serve low-income Texans, often for mental health services. The pulling of the waiver was seen as a move by the Biden administration to try to push Texas towards expanding Medicaid, but that just didn't happen. John Harrison is the president and CEO of TORCH, the Texas Organization of Rural and Community Hospitals. He says more rural hospitals are going to close because of this decision.
The outcome for rural Texas hospitals specifically is a very treacherous, scary path. Without either expansion or a waiver.
So explain what the waiver did.
It did several things, but primarily it provided federal funds for uncompensated care. Texas leads the country in both the number and percent of uninsured population. There are more than 5 million uninsured Texans. And so the waiver provided a funding mechanism to cover some of that cost for the safety net hospitals in the state, since we didn't expand Medicaid.
When the Biden administration pulled that 1115 waiver, Greg Abbott, governor, he blasted the Biden administration's decision. He called this as obstructing health care access for vulnerable Texans. He sent a letter just saying that this was a decision that was going to impact the poor in Texas directly. That kind of seems weird that he would use that argument, seeing how the legislature had a perfect opportunity to rectify all that with the expansion of Medicaid.
Well, but we make the point that those two conversations are not mutually exclusive. Even if Texas expanded Medicaid, we best case scenarios, we'd cover about 1.2 million of those 5 million uninsured. So you still have an uninsured problem. And, I would say that actually both the Biden White House and the governor are partly right. and there's clear political tension between the state of Texas and the federal government at this point.
The Biden administration has put incentives on the table as well to encourage
Yep.
states to take up Medicaid expansion now more than ever. So this would have been a really good opportunity for the state to find resources for rural hospitals and other low-income people who are uninsured, isn't it?
It's never been about the math. It's a really good deal for states like Texas. It would actually be budget positive, neutral at worst, budget positive in most scenarios, and the federal government keeps doing things to make it an even better deal. But it's not about the math. It's about the politics.
Right. So you have to wonder, like, is Oklahoma a socialist state? I mean, they've expanded Medicaid.
Well, that's an interesting point. Oklahoma, and I think every state that has had this issue on the ballot has passed it. So it's undefeated on the ballot. But in Texas, it's still a matter of whether the state legislature can get comfortable with it. And in the last 10 years, they haven't.
All the states that surround Texas have expanded Medicaid in one way or another. Arkansas is using a plan which is very tailored to their needs. It's not exactly expanding Medicaid, and it's a little more robust than just the 1115 waiver that we have had in Texas. And that seemed to be what Democrats were angling for, mm-hmm. And saying Texas can produce its own path, its own conservative way to do this. Would that have worked for you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Any path will work for me as long as we find a way to cover more Texans. The Arkansas model specifically was coverage expansion through a private market mechanism, you know, the commercial health plans. I think the plan with the most traction in Texas is actually modeled after the Indiana model, which is a waiver with a private market mechanism, kind of like Arkansas. But yes, we would support that or, you know, any other method to get us to more insured Texans, specifically in rural Texas.
I have this conversation with you every session. I think this is the third time we've done this, talking about we need to throw rural hospitals a lifeline. But now it seems like Texas is refusing to throw you a lifeline, but they are willing to throw you an anvil. Is this worse than ever? Because we have no longer the waiver, the 1115 waiver, and Texas is not going to expand Medicaid. What does this mean for rural hospitals?
Worst case scenario with no waiver and no expansion, it truly is catastrophic for rural Texas hospitals. I still remain optimistic that cooler heads will prevail and somehow we'll get back to the negotiating table and figure something out. With the waiver over the next year or so, and with expansion, if not during this state legislative session, then in either a special session or the next one.
Does seem a little bit like the federal government, Biden administration, and the state government, Greg Abbott. It's like a game of chicken with the poor people in Texas in the middle.
Well, that's an apt description. I think there probably are negotiations, if not publicly, that are happening right now, with Cornyn blocking the CMS secretary appointment in the short term. And since Texas has not yet filed a lawsuit to contest the waiver cancellation, my guess, and I don't know this, is that there are some kind of negotiation or at least conversation going on between, you know, state leaders and the federal government.
We've seen rural hospitals closing. Talk about that for listeners who may not understand what that means for a community.
We've been reminded during the pandemic of the importance of access to care. And thankfully, we haven't had a rural hospital close in the last year, but that was the first time in more than 10 that we haven't had at least. Rural hospitals, in a lot of ways, hold rural communities up. And it's not just access to an emergency room. It's also, you know, good jobs that the community needs. So rural hospitals are kind of foundational to rural economic development.
Even though Texas is seeing growth in population overall, there's about 50 counties that have seen decreased populations over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And is there a connection between these areas that have lost their hospitals and they have shed population?
Well, population's a factor. Obviously, federal and state cuts to programs like Medicare and Medicaid, this uninsured population. The demographics in rural Texas are challenging. So all of those things are factors that contribute to the vulnerability of rural Texas hospitals.
I mean, who wants to move to a county where the closest hospital is 150 miles away?
Exactly. And that's particularly true, I would say, for young families, you know, that want to have access to OB care or something of that nature. You just aren't going to pick a community that's so isolated to not have healthcare services.
But a lot of these counties are seeing aging populations as well, and they really need accessible healthcare.
Yeah, it's true on the other end of the age spectrum too, where you have this vulnerable elderly population in the Medicare program that need to live near access to care. Now, telemedicine is changing that somewhat, but when you're having a heart attack or a stroke, you know, you still need an emergency room.
Or if you're working out in the rural areas, even if you're up in your ages, you still, you know, you have gates that swing when they're not supposed to swing and people get hurt.
Yep. And rattlesnakes and car accidents and all those things that even if it's unplanned require medical intervention.
So there's still some time left on the clock with the legislature. Is there time for this to for a solution to be hammered out?
There is time, but I'll be honest with you, I just don't see a path. I was actually expecting the House to pass it and there be some momentum yesterday, but honestly didn't see a path through the Senate or the Lieutenant Governor or Governor's office. So I think the fact that the House amendment to expand coverage failed yesterday doesn't bode well for any kind of restarting of the expansion conversation in the next 6 weeks.
All right, so there are people who are going to look at the rural areas of Texas and see how they vote. And typically it's 80% plus Republican. And they see how Republican lawmakers are the ones that are pulling out the plugs on these rural hospitals and Medicaid expansion. They see that, well, this is what you got. This is what you vote for.
That's an interesting dynamic, and rural communities have not always voted their interest, but I actually defend them to an extent. We characterize them as low-trust communities, and I would say historically and even through the pandemic and with the vaccine rollout, the government hasn't given these communities a lot of reason to trust them. You know, they haven't acted in a trustworthy way. But I don't know what that means in terms of future election cycles, but you're right. rural Texas is still deep red and generally opposed to expansion, even though 70% of the rural hospital closures have happened in non-expansion states.
So given the path we're on now, do you think we'll see a more rural hospital closures?
If nothing changes, certainly. And we're talking about probably a dozen more. I remain hopeful that we'll be able to work something out either with the expansion conversation or the waiver conversation. But yes, if we don't get either, we've got problems.
John Harrison is the president and CEO of Torch, Texas Organization of Rural and Community Hospitals. It's been busy at the Texas legislature, on top of bills to overhaul elections, new restrictions on abortion, expansion of gun access, and attacks on Texans who are transgender. The Texas legislature is also moving forward on government transparency bills. There is bipartisan support to promote open government and also address failings in the public information arena that became evident during the COVID-19 pandemic. Kelly Shannon is the executive director of the nonprofit Freedom of Information Foundation of Texas.
We always know about certain areas that need to be addressed or problems that are rippling up, you know, in the public information laws. But with the COVID-19 pandemic, many of those problems just got magnified or new ones cropped up. Things we had never envisioned, because naturally none of us had ever envisioned this type of pandemic. So we really kept track of these throughout the year. We tried to help folks as they were trying to access their government. And as we approached the legislative session, we knew that action needed to happen to improve and solidify the public's right to know.
A lot of meetings moved online. Was that a good thing or a bad thing for transparency?
Well, it depends on your viewpoint. It's good that government could still progress and have its meetings online and let folks in to see and view it online. We do have problems, though. Not everybody in Texas has internet access. There's millions of Texans who do not have home internet access. So some of those people were left out of the equation. One of our bills that we're working on is to ensure that if a virtual meeting takes place, if an online meeting takes place, there's always a telephone call-in line as well, because we want everyone to be able to participate and observe.
Yeah, so the big question has been, has government accountability been on mute during the pandemic?
In some cases, it has. Some governments have really gone the extra mile to try to make things work, just like the private sector has been doing. We have to think of new and creative ways to do our jobs, and many governments have done that. However, some governments have just shut things down, and particularly in the area of public records, the Public Information Act, which deals with documents and records, that has been problematic because so many governments have said, because our physical doors are closed and we're working remotely, we don't have to respond to Public Information Act requests. They're going by old, outdated attorney general guidance, and they're sort of making up their own rules as they go along. So we're trying to correct this problem as well during the current legislative session.
So weren't they working off the idea that if there's a natural disaster and it hits a county, the local government is so overwhelmed dealing with that disaster that they need to hit pause on dealing with these public information requests? But we had a different kind of natural disaster, one that hit the entire state and lasted for over a year. And so we saw a lot of governmental agencies put up just disclaimers on their website saying, we're dealing with a pandemic, we're on a skeleton crew, we can't meet your request. And it seemed to be disingenuous for some of these agencies.
That's right. We've got a two-pronged approach that happened. There is a provision in the law that was passed last legislative session called a catastrophe notice, where a government can file a notice with the Attorney General's office and say, we've got this disaster that's happened here. We can't possibly deal with Public Information Act requests for the next 7 days, like a seven-day period. And then they can go up to a 14 days possible, like another extension to take them to 14 days. That may be understandable. You're just getting your bearings. You're trying to regroup. You're trying to deal with the, you know, what's happening on the ground. But that is for a short term, a limited time. Then what happened after using that new catastrophe notice provision, governments started just saying, well, actually, we're just shut down until further notice. We're working remotely, or we're working on skeleton crew, which lets them allegedly say they are not counting it as business days and don't have to respond to Public Information Act requests. That is where some governments are just making up the rules as they go along. And that's what we are trying to put a stop to. We're trying to have a really uniform definition of business days so that, you know, we can answer Public Information Act requests. You know, today, many, if not most records that people seek are available electronically. So even if your staff, your government staff is working at home and working on their computer, they can, and they're getting paid their government salary, they can still respond to Public Information Act requests.
During a pandemic, that public information could be even more important than ever, particularly if you have governmental agencies that aren't willing to be forthcoming about infection rates or fatalities or and the spending that goes into those things.
That is so true. All of those points you just made, we saw play out during the past year. For instance, nursing homes where there were outbreaks, there were local governments, and even for a while, the state government not telling folks, here is the location of an outbreak, so that residents of that home and their loved ones had the information they needed to make good decisions about, you know, where to live and how to take precautions. We had different people around the state trying to find out what was going on in school districts, what they were spending on COVID precautions or what they were doing to deal with COVID. School districts in some cases said, no, we're not going to answer you. You know, we're shut down. There were others who were trying to find out what was going on in the jails. You know, were inmates being tested? Were they being isolated if they had COVID? You know, what's going on in the jails? What was happening to protect the correction officers? Many times this type of information was withheld. People could not get what they were asking for. So as you say, during a time of crisis like this, during an emergency that's affecting everyone, public information becomes even more important.
You always have a bipartisan caucus of lawmakers who really understand the importance of strong transparency and public information. But given what we've been through through COVID-19 pandemic and a lot of these issues and questions that have come up, has that caucus grown?
Well, it actually has. It grows every session. So this session, we have once again a bipartisan group of legislators who are pushing through bills that are going to try to address the problems with open government that we saw during the pandemic, and even some that were existing before the pandemic. So yes, there are even new legislators on board this session, and that's a great sign.
Kelly Shannon is the executive director of the nonprofit Freedom of Information Foundation of Texas. For more information, you can go to foift.org. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.